I'm interested in diving into the core of the artist torment that drives the work that you make. What is the sort of twisted origin story that led you to pursue a career in comedy?
I think, I guess the most obvious one would being like the fourth of five children in a house where both parents work full-time. I guess that sort of positioning makes you desperate for attention. But I don't know, it probably runs deeper than that. I guess that's the surface answer, but probably just some sort of genetic defect or something.
Well, that scans. So I'm interested, you know, in your career, you've been a comedian, you've been a podcaster, you've been a musician. In this day and age, do you think that to make a career in the arts requires that kind of ability to jump between practices?
Yeah, I mean, I think unless you're able to, you know, really hit it out of the park doing one thing, I think it's always good to have, like, different areas where you can reach people and do your thing and be creative and all that. But, I mean, for me, a lot of it has to do with I just really like doing a variety of things. So I wish I could get myself to focus on maybe a couple things, but I just get like, you know, like you could, I could meet you and you could say, Dave, do you want to make a puppet show? And I'd be like, yeah, let's do it. Take it on. I'm just easily led, easily talked into things. So, you know, whether it's like writing something with someone or forming a band or whatever it is, I like doing all sorts of things.
So back in the early 90s, you were sort of in the midst of the alt-rock explosion with your band Sons of Elvis. In those heady days of the early 90s, what was it like to be in a band getting attention on MTV and touring colleges and things like that?
It was super exciting because, you know, I grew up, I mean, like a lot of kids, I guess, like I grew up like just wanting to play in a rock band. And I grew up, you know, when MTV was kind of just was really a thing where you would turn it on and be, you know, see music videos all the time, which, you know, wasn't really a thing until the 80s, I guess, where you would do with it, you know. And so to kind of realize a lot of my teenage dreams on some small level and, you know, get a record deal out of college was super exciting because we were, you know, we formed that band. Three of us went to grade school, high school, and college together, and then we met the singer, John Borland, at Fordham, where we all went to school. And, you know, we were just drunk and horrible when we formed. And then to actually, you know, get a record deal and get on the radio and see our video on MTV at 3 in the morning and, you know, just all the things we kind of thought would be so cool. And then, you know, is that in after, you know, that was like in 95, so it's kind of after this whole, you know, alternative music revolution or whatever. And so it was exciting to kind of be doing it then. But, you know, as these things go, we're sort of a casualty of the whole thing, and it was all kind of a blip in the whole big picture of life. But it was super fun to just get to do that and to do all the stuff that I dreamt of as a kid.
And you were a kid in Cleveland, Ohio, a city that is unfortunately frequently maligned and has a bit of a reputation. What is your experience of Cleveland, and what do you think people should know about what some dub the mistake by the lake?
Cleveland's awesome. I mean, I was just talking with someone about this today. It's, you know, it's the one thing, you know, it's pretty gray and rainy. The lake effect is a real thing, and it can be a lot to deal with emotionally. It's kind of, I always say Cleveland is like London without all the stuff, you know what I mean? Like, it would be like if you took away the hundreds of years of history and the architecture and everything, you would pretty much have Cleveland. So, but I love Cleveland. There's great stuff. And I think any city, anywhere in the world, ultimately, the city's greatest asset is the people who live there, you know. And I would absolutely say it about Cleveland. And it's why New York is still such a great city as well, even as much as it changes and is kind of being overrun by wealth, just as every other major international city is kind of just driving out everyone but the super wealthy. I think there's still just a lot of great people here.
Speaking of the super wealthy, your career has taken you to all different corners of the globe, from working with Moby to playing on the Jon Stewart show to meeting everyone from Snoop Dogg to Rick Rubin and Malcolm Gladwell in the mix there as well. What are some of the highlights of your career working in media? When you think back on the Dave Hill experience, what are the real peaks of the whole thing?
I think just, you know, being able to have a lot of experiences that have come from doing the things that I do, you know, whether, you know, I've performed stand-up comedy at Sing Sing Prison, and that was probably the only way I would get into Sing Sing with being allowed to leave, you know. And so it's interesting taking what I do and being able to, you know, I'm going to do a show in Krakow, Poland, and, you know, Budapest this summer. I think I'm supposed to do shows in India in the fall. And so the opportunity to go to places maybe I never would have gone otherwise. But also, I think it's exciting to, you know, when my heroes know what I do and like what I do and tell other people that they're fans of what I do. You know, like one of my dearest friends in the whole world is Dick Cavett, who was like, I never saw the Dick Cavett show when it was on, but I became a fan, you know, growing up seeing him on other talk shows and being able to then see his show. And, you know, I think he's one of the most amazing people on the planet, and to have him say that I'm doing all right, that I'm doing a good job is amazing. You know, people like that. You know, I just did a show in London, and Eddie Izzard came out, and I mean, huge fan of his, and to have the people that I admire and look up to, you know, tell me that I'm okay is a great feeling and means more to me than anything else, you know, because just growing up, you know, and seeing these people I admired and then people like Chris Elliott, I've done a few things with him over the years, and to have these people even acknowledge that I exist, you know, after being just worshiping what they do is pretty cool.
Recently, you joined the rarefied air of the cadre of Twitter users who have been banned from using the service. Can you speak a little bit to what happened there and why you're no longer welcome in the land of Twitter?
I mean, it's pretty nuts. I was for... You know, for a while now, as anyone who knows anything about me, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, to put it extremely mildly. I had been tweeting stuff at Trump, and he would, you know, probably never see it, I'm sure, but his supporters would, and they would, you know, come back with insults and death threats sometimes, and all sorts of homophobic and transphobic remarks, you know, and I would reply with like fifth grade level mother jokes, you know, like just stupid juvenile stuff that like a 12, 11 or whatever 10-year-old would say, and I was permanently banned for it. The tweets that they selected, they said I was permanently banned for. And it's insane, you know, in terms of like, oh, Dave Hill, this is, you know, not wildly popular comedian, it's not that big of a deal. But in terms of like, you know, it's pretty arbitrary and like capricious, I think, on their part. And just dumb, but it's also pretty funny. And I don't know. I talked to my manager about it, and she said that she thinks they're kind of knocking out, you know, some liberal prominent voices, if you can call me one, which is, you know, I guess you could in that I had 55,000 followers and I, you know, had a check mark, blue check mark or whatever. So she was saying she thought, you know, it's like they're kind of just to prove that they're not just removing right-wing nut jobs. They're going to take out some liberal comedians while they're at it. So, I don't know. It's pretty ridiculous. And I'll tell you, though, it's pretty nice not being on Twitter. Now I just, instead of thinking of stuff to tweet, I just have thoughts and I go about my day. But I do think in terms of free speech and all that, it is a bit scary that they're weeding out people like that. People like me, I should say. Oh, I'm sorry. My dog is getting involved. She loves me not being on Twitter because I have more time to go to the dog park.
So you're coming up to the Berkshires on June 8th to appear at the Barn in Egremont. What kind of zone are you in right now, Dave? What kind of humor and good tidings can people expect from your appearance in the Berkshires?
I'm doing a lot of training, a lot of crunches, a lot of wind sprints. I'm excited because I've done a show there once before, like a year or two ago, and I had a super blast. I love the Berkshires. I love Egremont Barn. I love Jenny Rubin, who runs the place. And I'm also, you know, I'm getting ready to do a bunch of shows this summer in Europe and UK and all that. And then I'm recording an album in the fall, so this would be a nice opportunity to see what sticks and hopefully get better at telling my quote-unquote jokes. But yeah, I'm super pumped about it. I look forward to staying over at the Egremont Inn. I love it. I wish I could just do a show there every Saturday night. So if they would have me, I'm in. Everyone should come too. That goes without saying. Jordan Carlos, Claire O'Kane, and Jenny Rubin are also with the four of us. And all three of them are hilarious. I'm huge fans of them. And so I'm excited to be there as an audience member as well.
Well, I'm happy you actually put it that way. Because as much as you're a performer, you're also a fan. I'm interested, what records or books or pieces of media are hot on your list this spring?
Oh, gosh. I have now I have to go look. What did I just read a book that I could tell you. I just read this book that I really enjoyed. I'll tell you right now. I'm reading The Woman Inside by E.G. Scott, which is actually two writers, Greg Wands and Liz Keenan. They write together under a pseudonym or nom de plume or whatever, and it's a thriller. And everyone should go get that. And so there's some nice fiction for people. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I just read this book called Blood, Fire, Death, which subtitle The Swedish Metal Story. And it's all about Swedish metal. And so I really enjoyed that book. I love reading about just cultures and people getting up to crazy stuff, and that was fun. I guess you'd have to be a heavy metal fan to really get on board with that. And I'm trying to think what else. There's so many. I mean, of course I want to tell everyone to buy my book, Parking the Moose, which is out in October via Doubleday, which is part of Penguin. And what else? Okay, I'll give you one more. The Kids in the Hall, One Dumb Guy by Paul Myers, who's a Canadian author. And it's just a story of the Kids in the Hall, which are, you know, one of the greatest sketch comedy troupes of all time. And so if you like Kids in the Hall, those are sort of specialized taste books, but they're all great. I guess I'm trying to think what else. I just read The Power of Now, which I recommend if you're looking to you're on the path toward enlightenment, or you'd like to be. I'm not enlightened, but I'm trying. I'll die trying.